From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Netflix just lost subscribers here in the States. Is it a blip or reason to worry? Then Gigi Saul Guerrero found inspiration for her horror film about immigration in an unexpected place, war propaganda posters.
They have been promoting America as this perfect, perfect place. Beautiful pastels and, you know, apple pie, perfect families, perfect homes. So I was like, what if we actually went into those propaganda posters?
And the composer of Midsommar used Swedish folk music in a made-up language for the film's frightening score. All that coming up on The Frame.
Hi, this is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights. The screening Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
Netflix stock tumbled about 10% today. That comes after the streaming content leader lost some 130,000 subscribers in the United States, the first domestic decline since 2011. Netflix also added just 2.7 million new customers overseas, which was well below projections. The company's executives say it's a minor blip and are confident that popular shows such as Stranger Things will help turn the subscriber numbers around. Interestingly, Netflix actually beat Wall Street expectations in terms of per-share profits, but those margins could come under pressure as new streaming services such as Disney Plus and HBO Max are scheduled to compete against Netflix in the coming months. I spoke with Variety's Todd Spangler to get more about what's going on with the streaming giant.
The company cited the price increases that it has undertaken in both the United States and other countries. And obviously that has an effect of causing some people to leave the service and inhibit others from signing up. They also said that in the second quarter, it was a lighter, you know, less marquee kind of a content lineup as opposed to some of these bigger tentpole shows that they've got coming up through the second half of the year. Second quarter is also light for TV watching in general. So all of these things contributed to them really missing their forecast.
One of the analysts that you talk with said the company was in danger, I'm quoting him now, of becoming a premium cable network on steroids. And part of what's happening to Netflix is companies are taking back their content that they used to license to Netflix and putting it on their own or upcoming streaming services. So if you buy into that theory, the premium cable network on steroids, what are the opportunities and what are the challenges if that's their future business?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think anybody expects all of Netflix's licensing deals to go away, even in the long term. There will still be independent studios that, you know, will want to get a big check from Netflix. So that's not going away. The other thing to keep in mind is even though you've got Disney and Warner Media and NBC and among others, you know, reclaiming some of their popular content for their own streaming services, these are individual titles that, you know, presumably Netflix will be able to compensate for over the long run with original programming.
And even though Netflix historically has been very shy or private or secret about how many people are watching what shows, we do know that shows like Stranger Things, Ava DuVernay's documentary When They See Us, Adam Sandler's murder mystery movie have been watched by a lot of people, and that is content that Netflix is either producing or acquiring from other parties. It's not coming from rival studios. Is that possibly the model going forward, that instead of Friends or The Office, that it's going to be that kind of content that, in theory, will drive and retain subscribers?
Right. Well, first of all, most of the data that we hear is from Netflix touting the success or supposed success of their own projects. So you do have research from Nielsen and some other companies that bolster the argument, but we don't have a way to independently verify it. And the reason for that is Netflix doesn't have to share data because they're not ad supported.
Well, let me ask you that. Is there a scenario that some analysts are talking about where there might be advertisements on Netflix that could be different tiers of pricing depending on how much advertising, if any, you're willing to watch.
In their earnings announcement yesterday, they pretty firmly said this is a complete non-starter. They said we do not have any plans to do this, and any speculation that we will is false. So that was pretty strongly worded coming out of Netflix about sticking to their subscription-only business model.
Like a lot of Hollywood companies, Netflix has enjoyed tremendous growth outside of the United States. And one of the more notable things about the earnings was that the rate of growth for international subscribers, while they did add 2.7 million new subscribers worldwide, that was not what they were hoping for or expected to get. So how much of the company's future is really contingent on growing subscribers overseas? Because Netflix is also investing in a lot of foreign language production.
Yeah, the company is mostly an international company in terms of its subscriber base. And the opportunity for growth is clearly much bigger outside of the United States than it is in the U.S., where people are seeing that they're bumping up against maybe a natural ceiling of the number of customers that they can sign up.
Yeah, and it's obviously going to be a value proposition for the subscribers, and the fact that subscriptions went down right around the time that Netflix boosted the monthly fees, not at all a coincidence, was it?
Well, no, and they did admit that they missed their subscriber forecasts, particularly in areas where they have raised the pricing. And some of the conventional wisdom going into this was that, boy, you know, Netflix is priced pretty well under HBO's standalone streaming service, you know, and they're really affordable when you compare it to traditional cable or satellite TV. Well, when Netflix dialed it up a little higher to about $13 a month for the standard plan, I think they saw that some people were not having it.
But $13 in some cities like New York and L.A. barely gets you a big tub of popcorn at a movie theater. Todd Spangler is the New York digital editor for Variety. Todd, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on The Frame, Gigi Saul Guerrero's Culture Shock is a timely and terrifying story about immigration. If horror movies really make you squeamish, you might want to come back in about 11 minutes.
This just in, the president's 25th tweet of today once again reiterates his firm wish for the wall. Quote, need funding for the wall now. Dear illegals, remember, as you sow, so shall you reap. So true.
That's not an actual newscast, but it's obviously inspired by real life. It's a scene from Culture Shock, part of the horror anthology series Into the Dark on Hulu. Culture Shock was directed by Gigi Saul Guerrero, who was born in Mexico and lives in Canada. The film tells the story of a pregnant Mexican woman who illegally crosses the U.S. border and finds herself in a perplexing town. The sci-fi story mixes real-life drama with Guerrero's first love, horror movies.
I'm going to have to blame my mom for the outcome, definitely. I come from a very, very Mexican, very Catholic house. And ever since a little kid, I was really not allowed to watch any of that. And of course, the outcome was that I just became very, very curious as to what is she hiding from me? Like, why can I see all of this? And it all started, you know, as a kid after school. The only thing I was watching when I was little would be secretly plastic surgeries on TV.
Oh, my God.
That was like, I would watch Flintstones, Chavo del Ocho, and like another show. And I'm like, okay, plastic surgeries are on. I gotta watch, you know, like. And so it all began. I got a little bit rebellious, and I stole. Well, Mexicans, we don't steal. We just borrow for a long time. But I took a VHS from Blockbuster when I was 8 years old. It was Child's Play 2.
You've been very naughty, Miss Kettlewell.
I couldn't help it. I was just like, I need to take something because what is it that I'm not allowed to see? And ever since then, I experienced what fear is. But I loved it. I loved how a movie could follow you home.
Did you also have a chance when you were growing up, I'm thinking of the early movies like Cronos and Mimic by Guillermo del Toro, were you able to actually see, not that I have anything against Child's Play 2, but like real good filmmakers dealing with horror in a creative way?
I didn't start seeing movies like that until I was actually in film school. And I didn't really quite watch horror as much. Like, I just liked it as a fan. And it wasn't until film school that I met one of my best friends, and his name is Luke Bramley. And he was like, Gigi, let me show you the way of the dark side. And he introduced me to exactly the movies you just said. I never really heard of Guillermo del Toro, and he showed me Rob Zombie's work. Like, I remember seeing Devil's Rejects.
I am the devil, and I am here to do the devil's work.
And I was like, oh my God, there's movies as raw as this. Like, I couldn't believe I haven't really seen much such creative and authentic horror. And it totally changed my perspective on it. And I just started getting obsessed in a way where I wanted to be a storyteller like that.
I want to ask about your movie Culture Shock, which is part of the In the Dark anthology series. There are so many different ways to imagine how you got connected to this material. And I'm wondering what grabbed you first. What was the appeal? And what were the kinds of things you wanted to do inside this story?
I really felt if I can do this film, I can bring those layers of authenticity as a Mexican and as a woman. You know, the protagonist is a Mexican female. And I felt this is the script for me. I can really bring a lot because I'm an immigrant too, and the movie touches about immigration. I come from Mexico City to Vancouver. Man, that was the biggest culture shock that I experienced. So I completely understood what this script needed. And so, you know, it was really amazing when Blumhouse Productions gave me the chance to pitch, and that was the first thing I told them. You know, I said, if you guys let me do this, I will make it so Mexican, it's going to go appreciated a long way.
We're talking with Gigi Saul Guerrero, who is the director of Into the Dark, Culture Shock on Hulu. Really good horror movies, and I'm thinking of movies like Get Out or 28 Days Later, can really examine an issue and have some sort of social commentary. And I'm wondering, when you are thinking about what horror can do in terms of storytelling, why is it a good match for also making some sort of commentary on the world we're living in?
Ever since exploitation films, they are the best kind of storytelling to be able to escape the reality of the horrors we actually live in and manipulate them in any way you want and actually make it entertaining. And in Culture Shock, it starts off very real and gritty and raw and quite scary as we watch these characters illegally cross from Mexico into the U.S. But then it totally changes to this insane Stepford Wife, Pleasantville gone wrong, funny, humorous other world. We have to realize that the people that carry these films or films in general is our audiences. So, you know, so why make a movie of this type, as Culture Shock, as horrifying as the news, when I gotta have these audiences sit and be entertained? In genre, you can do that, and you can be entertained and just let go of the horrifying things that we live in.
There's a scene early on in Culture Shock where your main character, Marisol, confronts the coyote, or smuggler, who she previously paid to take her in the United States, but left her behind.
Debe ser difícil abandonar a la gente en la frontera. Sobre todo cuando te pagaron tanta lana, ¿no?
Mi trabajo es un poco complicado.
What he says is it's a complicated job, and that brainwashing them, the people who are coming across, with the idea of this so-called land of opportunity.
Porque donde venimos, nuestros sueños no merecen ser
realizados.
And that really goes to an extreme in this series, that the land of opportunity is imagined in some characters' minds as this kind of hyper-American, pure white, where everybody speaks English and everybody is kind of de-racified. And I'm wondering why that idea was important to you, that there was this alternate version of reality.
You know, for a lot of us immigrants, we are always searching for not just a better life, but a fair chance in life. And what is that dream that's going to make it come true? So for a lot of us, you know, we have this idea that has been promoted to us of a better, let's say, of a better America or a better country or world or whatever. And, you know, the inspiration to making that American dream feel so perfect, almost like you're saying, I was very inspired very much from the old war propaganda posters, because since then, they have been promoting America as this perfect, perfect place, beautiful pastels, and, you know, apple pie, perfect families, perfect homes. So I was like, what if we actually, in the movie, went into those propaganda posters? What would it be like from an immigrant's point of view? We in Spanish don't really have a saying like you do in English of too good to be true. And I was like, you know, I kind of want to play with that. Kind of reminds me of like a perfect date. If it's too good to be true, I gotta get back. I gotta call the Uber and like leave. If something's too good to be true, I don't trust it.
The other thing that you seem very intent on is showing how difficult the crossing is and how vulnerable the people are who are in it.
I definitely have family on my side who have attempted such an act. And, you know, all the things in culture shock that we portray are so real. And it's exactly how it goes down. And I find it quite terrifying and quite sad that you have to reach such a level of desperation to want a fair chance in life. Like, that's, you must be not necessarily out of your mind, but you must be that desperate and anxious to have something better for you. And these characters definitely show that. And even the character Ricky, the 10-year-old boy, I wanted to show someone outside of Mexico, making him from Guatemala, and showing what it's like for them to cross. They actually have to pose as Mexicans.
Mexicanos al grito de guerra, el acero a prestar y el bridón.
Learn the anthem, get a fake Mexican ID, so if they get deported back, they only get deported halfway and not all the way down. And that, to me, is terrifying, especially as a kid traveling alone. That happens. That was one of the things I was excited to tell the studio was, let's not be so vanilla about it and let's talk about it. If we're going to talk about it, let's go 100% as successfully as, you know, Get Out or even some of the Black Mirror episodes. Like, they really, really portray the world that we live in.
Gigi Saul Guerrero is the director of Culture Shock. It's part of the anthology series Into the Dark that's out now on Hulu. Gigi, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, another scary film, how the composer of Midsommar used Swedish folk music and a made-up language to write the film's frightening score. The Haxan Cloak sounds a bit like an object from the Harry Potter books, but it's really the pseudonym of musician and film composer Bobby Krilich. I visited his Silver Lake studio recently to talk about his writing the music for Midsommar. That's Ari Aster's new film about some young Americans who visit a Swedish commune and fall prey to a cult's horrifying rituals. Krilich's score suits the plot perfectly, and that's because Aster had written the Midsommar script while listening to some earlier work by the Haxan Cloak.
When I read the script, there's kind of a pastoral quality to it. And then also, you know, a lot of the music that I'd sort of written was influenced by a lot of devotional music and music of kind of cults and things like that. So it seemed like a pretty, it was a no-brainer, really.
And you also go out and find vintage
Swedish string instruments? What were you looking for and what did you use?
Well, what happened with that is I did a hell of a lot of research into old Scandinavian, Nordic, Icelandic music. I can kind of play violin a little bit and play cello a little bit. So I kind of made these demos myself. And then I found some libraries, like sort of orchestral libraries on the computer. And they had things like hurdy-gurdy and the nickel harper and fiddles and these huge hang drums. And so, you know, I made all these pieces, and then we actually had an instrument maker in Sweden who was making these pieces from scratch. You know, I was in constant conversations with him, sending him the pieces I was writing, and he was sending me diagrams and pictures of all the instruments he was making. And, you know, so it was about as authentic as we could possibly have made it.
Do people just sleep here?
Yeah, all the younger ones, until we turn 36, and then we move to the laborer's house.
Why 36?
Well, we think of life like the seasons. So you're a child until you're 18, and that's spring. And then at some point, we all do our pilgrimage, which is between 18 and 36, and that's summer.
The story is set in a place that doesn't have a lot of modern influences. There's no television.
Yeah.
There's no really modern things at all. And yet, it is a modern story. It's set in the present day.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you in terms of turn-of-the-century instruments, which is kind of where these people are kind of frozen in time,
yeah,
on the one hand, and then electronics on the other hand, which also seems to be part of how you're putting the music together.
The majority of the electronics in the film were actually, you know, analog synthesizers recorded to tape. And then I would watch the film and manipulate the pitch of the tape while I was watching the film. And then, you know, these things would then get transcribed for orchestra, and the orchestra would kind of mimic what the electronics were doing. So, you know, I was kind of trying to put myself in a pretty limited technological space. So I had all these kind of string recordings of really high-pitched strings, and then cymbals and gongs. And what I would do is I would record that to tape, and then I would slow the tape down to half or a quarter speed. And you ended up with this kind of sound that's almost like, it's like wind. And it's kind of atonal, and it's this kind of like really strange drone. I wanted that to be the sound of the Hagas and their kind of hive mind mentality and the kind of brainwashing that happens over these people. It's almost at a subliminal level in the film, but as soon as they get on the plane, that's when that sound comes in, and it's nearly from there all the way until the end.
There are a couple scenes in the movie, and I'm thinking of one scene in particular where characters are performing. They're, and in this case, they're performing a chant that involves sex. I want to ask you about the broader collaboration between what people are doing in the scene beyond speaking, where they're actually singing, because there's a lot of chanting, a lot of kind of choral music that is incorporated into the score. What was the theory behind how that performance would be incorporated into the music?
That was actually a collaboration between me and a really incredibly talented vocalist called Jessica Kenny. And when Ari approached me to score Midsommar, he also said, you know, on top of the score, we're going to have this diegetic music that the cast perform. And the instrumental stuff, you know, I was pretty fine with. That was kind of in my wheelhouse. But when it came to developing a ritualistic, atonal, wordless language, you know, I needed to reach out to some people to kind of help me figure out what that was. And Jessica turned out to be perfect. You know, has a degree in interpreting religious texts and sacred texts into song. She developed an entirely fabricated language for the people in the film to sing that was rooted in Icelandic, Scandinavian, Middle Eastern. Like there's kind of all sorts of stuff going on in there.
Bobby Krilich, under the Haxan cloak, wrote the score for Midsommar. The film is in theaters now. And that's The Frame for today. If you subscribe to our weekly email newsletter, look for it today. If not, you can sign up now at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.